time now for our legend of the game, and we've been getting a few coaches and a few mentors over the last couple of weeks. We had Roy Masters last week, and now, Roman, we've pretty much got the mentor's mentor.
This man has done it all in many ways.
His record is unsurpassed, really, in Australian sport. It's great to have Rick Charlesworth, AO, as our legend of the game. Welcome to the program, Rick.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
We do appreciate it. Hockey, cricket, coaching, it seemed whatever you... medicine, parliamentarian, it seemed no matter what you turned your hand to, there was success. How did you start in a sporting sense with your cricket and your hockey? What encouraged you to play those two games, Rick?
Oh, I suppose, you know, it was another time then, but, you know, at school I played footy, AFL, hockey and cricket and a bit of tennis and... You had a go at everything, I love sport. Sport was important, and when I was about 15, I think I was a rover in the AFL. I remember, you'd run out of the pack with the ball, and some big guy would flatten me. I don't want to keep doing this, so. I put more time into hockey, which I'd played since primary school, and cricket was what you did in the summer.
Well, you played both at a very high level, Rick. Of course, with your cricket career, you played for Western Australia for many years. Did it get to a point though when you had to make a choice between one sport or the other?
Oh yeah, I think there were clashes all along the way. I mean, we used to win the Sheffield Shield every second year in WA in those days. And so there were one or two campaigns that I missed because there were the hockey commitments. There was a World Cup in the way, and there were other things that came into it. And so it was really a case of just, probably cricket came second, My friends who were really serious about cricket used to go off to England and play during the winter, and I'd stay here and play hockey, But one was summer, one was winter. There were occasionally crashes when the international stuff was on. But my last experience was we were preparing for the Moscow Olympics, of course.
Yeah.
And I was captain of WA in cricket, and I had to make a choice then. And unfortunately, I chose hockey during that season, then we didn't go to the Olympics, so it didn't work out so well.
It was
the
boycott.
The cricket side that you played with, you mentioned your success at Sheffield Shield level. Some pretty decent players in that side, Rick. What was it like playing with a Rodney Marsh and a Dennis Lilly and a young Kimberly Hughes?
Oh, well, yeah, I was in the first, under-19 tournament ever in 1970.
Okay.
In Melbourne, and Kim Hughes was the best player on our team. He was a couple of years younger than me, and so I played a lot of cricket with Kim Hughes. But of course, on my first Shield tour, Dennis Lilly was my roommate, so I was alongside some very great players, and we had terrific teams during that period. It was a really good era in which to play, and we would get 10,000 people. Each day on a Shield day, on the weekends, it was a different time, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But hockey was where your star really soared into the stratosphere, so to speak, Rick, and you actually were selected for 5 Olympic teams from 72, 76, 980, which, of course, was the boycott, unfortunately, 84 and 88. I was talking to Jimmy before. I can remember vividly the 76 Montreal Olympics because we had 2 great gold medal chances, Stephen Holland in the 1500 and the men's hockey team. And Stephen Holland was beaten for a bronze, and I think the whole nation was riding with the hockey side trying to get that gold. And you played New Zealand and lost 1-0. And I swear, my memory's fading, Rick, New Zealand had 1 shot at goal, Australia had 100.
Well, actually, it felt like that, but they actually played pretty well that day. But it was, I played 17 years in the national team, and I think I played nearly 30 times against New Zealand. They only beat us one day.
Gee, 17 years.
I was part of the most unsuccessful ever Australian Olympic team, we came home, a silver medal was the best we did.
Which is pretty good.
It's hard for people to sort of remember that. But, yeah, we beat the world champions and the world second best team three times to get to the gold medal match. There was a boycott in those Olympics, and so there were less teams in the other pool. So by the time we played a repechage game against India, which was the longest game in history, had 5 periods of extra time.
Wow.
So by the time we got to the final, we played 2 more games in New Zealand. I think probably in the end that was one of the things that brought us down.
Yeah. You mentioned the longevity that you had with the Kookaburras at that time. And this tended to be a trait that you carried over when you were coaching. But 1986 World Cup winners, player of the tournament. But just 2 years later, you say that's enough. Was there something about getting on or getting out when you're at your best?
No. I probably, you know, if I'd been coached the team, I wouldn't have selected me.
Right.
Okay.
In 88, I think, you know, I probably, you know, wasn't the player I had been earlier.
Right.
But we were in 88. We had a very good team again, but we lost 3 players in the last month before the Olympics for 2 injuries. You know, and I think that took the gloss off what was a really good team. The Olympics they're pretty hard. They come along once every 4 years, and you've got to get everything right on the day. And teams change and shift, and you know, I think our team in 1980, after we'd come second in 76, our team in 1980 was probably as good as and as fresh and ready as ever.
Right.
It was a team, and we didn't get to go, you know, and that can happen.
Mm.
That's the way it can. Exactly. That's the way it can occur. In 84, we lost in the semi-final to a ball that was hit from outside the scoring circle. You know, now these days you have a video replay and you get on with the game, you know. That's the fickle nature of the Olympics, I suspect.
Exactly. Rick, all you achieved as a player, can you describe then the Olympic experience for those of us who have never been fortunate enough to ever get that level of sport, but the Olympic experience as a participant, can you describe it?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're all pleased, you know, very excited to play for our country, but I think the Olympics in some ways was an extra dimension.
Yeah.
Maybe it's losing a bit of its gloss now. I'm not sure, no, that, you know, that it's that we're not more wedded to sort of club competition and local stuff than we are to the international sport, but certainly to go to an event in which every nation is part of it and, you know, to be in that environment. It's often very difficult, of course, because the accommodation's much poorer than you're used to, and, you know, the scheduling and the security ever since Munich has been horrendous. So all of those things make it a difficult competition to play in, you know, because just to get to train often is, you know, a 4-hour event.
Yeah.
I can imagine, yeah.
That's interesting, that point you made there about domestic competitions, and I guess it's more pronounced in somewhere like Western Australia and for the sports that you're talking about. And I'm presuming around cricket and hockey, with a similar body shape to what an AFL player would be and a similar athlete. Is that a concern in the states where AFL is dominant, that people are looking away from perhaps an international career and looking at, well, there's more opportunity in AFL and it's obviously the biggest game in town?
Oh yeah, it's the biggest game in town, and you don't have to really be elite. You know, there's 800 spots.
Yeah.
In the AFL, I think that's part of the deal. There's a lot of razzmatazz. I mean, I understand what this. Someone was telling me in the AFL there's 1,600 journalists covering the AFL. There's only 800 players. For our women's team, for instance, I coach the women's team, who are outstanding athletes. To get on the front page of the paper, you've got to be the world champion.
Yeah.
The AFL women's players are on the front page of the paper. They really haven't done much.
Exactly, yeah.
Yep.
And they're not athletes of the same quality.
Yeah.
So it's about media and marketing, it worries me, and it's about gladiators in the arena. The other week, for instance, here in Perth, we people paid $2 to go to an AFL game. Just across the river, there was West Australia versus New South Wales in cricket. There were 9 Australian players playing. There was no one there.
Yeah.
You know, 40,000 went along to watch the football match.
Yeah.
Now, I think that was a bit of a novelty event. And indeed, they were subsidised by the taxpayers because it cost $6 to actually get there on the train. Well, that's the taxpayers subsidising the AFL. I mean, those sorts of things I find extraordinary. That happens, but it does shift the balance a little bit. But there's lots of kids who want to compete on the big stage. There's lots of people who don't want to get beaten up in the game that they play. And so, there's a place for other sports. Our men's hockey team is still ranked number one in the world.
Yep.
And the boys who are playing in there are first choice athletes by any measure. So that'll still be the case. And they play in Europe, they play in India. There's all sorts of other exciting experiences available to them. And hopefully that'll continue.
You mentioned your time is with the Hockeyroos, who during that late 90s, early 2000s, Rick, I dare say were one of the most celebrated sporting teams in the country.
Yeah.
Did they, you talk about marketing and promotion and advertising dollars, were they able to compete at a reasonable level financially, or were these girls just playing primarily because of the love of their sport and to play for their country?
Well, there's a lot of hype and razzmatazz now about, women's sport, but in our sport during that time, we were ranked higher than the boys, and we did better than they did.
Yeah.
In our sport, the money that is available through the National Association, much of it, of course, from government, is shared equally, girls and the boys, So we've been doing that for 30 or 40 years. Everyone's running around excited now about, isn't this a shift? Well, in our sport, that's been the case since that time in the 90s, the team, which was very, very good, indeed, we're used to an environment like that. I mean, I don't think there's a sport in the country, probably tennis, where there is that sort of equal treatment of men and women. They were a terrific team. But as I said, one of the girls in our team during that time was a girl called Nova Peris.
Yes. Yep.
Who you would have all heard of, who competed in athletics in Sydney. She was fourth in the country in the 100 metres. So she was a good athlete by any measure. We had 5 girls in the team who were quicker than Nova.
Wow, gee.
But they weren't only over 40 metres,
yeah,
that's all we used to measure them. But they weren't competing in athletics. But they were outstanding athletes.
Great success with the women's from 93 to 2000. Great success with the men's from 2009 to 2014. What was your philosophy as a coach? From what I understand, it was really challenging people, playing them out of position, helping them gain perspective of what some of their teammates are doing. Is there a way you could distill what it was that made you the success as a coach, Rick?
Well, I don't think I ever met a player yet who knew how good they could be. And men or women, in our sport. And so my job, part of that was to take them to a place they didn't think they could go to. This is a team sport. You can't succeed alone.
Yes.
And so being able to sublimate your personal ambitions for the group, your capacity to connect with one another and work together, those things are crucial if you're going to succeed in a team game. As well as, you want everybody to reach their potential, and then you want them to reach their potential not only as an individual but also as a team player. And so trying to work on those sorts of things. Fortunately, we had centralised programs, because in a country like Australia, unless you have that at team level, national team level, then you really can't compete with those countries that are centralised.
Yeah, true. Rick, you had so much success in a team environment, so much success in leadership roles, particularly as a coach as well. I'm interested in why you decided to to run and actually stand as a member for Parliament, the federal member for Parliament for 10 years for Perth from 1983. I think the most dysfunctional team at times sometimes seems what comes out of politics in Canberra. How was that decade?
There's a chapter in my first book, Interesting Job, Terrible Lifestyle.
Yeah.
But I must say, you know, I mean, this is the clearinghouse of ideas, the Parliament. You know, this is where great ideas are born and developed and policy is made. And indeed, during that time, I was part of a very functional government.
True.
I'm very proud to be. You know, that was the Hawke and Keating government. And I think most people looking back now say that was pretty much an exemplar for how it ought to run. Mm. I think that I was working as a doctor in a hospital for a while, and then I was working general practice. I decided I didn't want to continue in general practice. I was going to do some more study or something completely different, and the political chance came along. Mm-hmm. During the Vietnam War, I was a student at university protesting against that war, and, you know, we keep making those mistakes. We went to Iraq a while back, which in my view was the worst public policy decision of my lifetime. And so, you know, I was interested in politics. I wanted to change things. And I got the opportunity, and I was part of what I think was a very, very functional government. Mm. But, yeah, one looks at what happens in Canberra and is horrified, I think, sometimes these days.
Mm. Yeah.
But it ought to be the place in which big ideas are measured and challenged and, indeed, from where policy develops. Mm. Unfortunately, when I was leaving, I think about 10 years later, they started to continuously monitor what the public were thinking and how people saw things. And, you know, the political theory was, well, you feed back to people what they want rather than actually take them to other places.
Yeah.
I think there were recently John Keyes was talking about the five or six big things that his government did. He was very successful, of course, in New Zealand.
Yes.
He said that each time they introduced a significant policy change, there was only 20% support by the public.
I think
the government needs to take people there, and, you know, those difficult decisions have to be made. That's what government's about. It's leading public opinion rather than necessarily just following it.
Leadership again.
Yeah. Who did you admire from it? Well, let's say leadership, but who had an imprint on you as a coach? Whose ideas did you borrow?
I think everybody that I was involved with, you know, I learned from all the coaches I had at different times. They all offered something, and I read a lot about coaching and other coaches. And, of course, you know, from my time in the Parliament, there were two great leaders in the government I was in, and that was Hawke and Keating.
Yeah.
And they were substantial people who wanted to make Australia in a different way better. Mm. And I think that, you know, in coaching, my view was that we had enough talent in this country, enough good players to be able to be a dominant force in the game. And so we played aggressively and assertively, and we prepared diligently. And if you do that, then you give yourself a chance.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky as a coach to have some of the most gifted athletes that our sport's ever seen, and that was a terrific experience.
Yeah. I think we've had a sports interview, Rick. I think we've covered a lot of
territory.
Politics and leadership and life philosophies, but we've thoroughly enjoyed it. We do appreciate your time, and I think we say this a lot, but it's fascinating the way you speak, and we could spend a lot more time with you. But unfortunately, we can't, but again, thank you for joining our program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Rick.
There he is, Rick Charlesworth, former Kookaburra, former West Australian cricketer, Member of Parliament.
He's done it all,
coach,
isn't he?
And by the way, he's a Doctor of Medicine.
Just
as
for
well.
Something different.
Yeah, exactly.